Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Sod 2 of For the Record Program 709, Update on Eurofascism. This program is being recorded on April 11th of the year 2010. We're going to jump right in because we got a lot of material to cover, and we only got a half hour to do it, and I ran out of time the last time I was talking about Eurofascism, and I'm afraid I might do the same here. By the way, please use the SpitfireList.com website. I turn every program into a rigorously annotated article-length description, and there's often material in the description that I did not have time to put in the broadcast as a whole, okay? So if there are holes in the broadcast, check out the whole description, so to speak. Forgive me, I know those horrible puns, but you can't win them all. We're going to plunge right in. Now, as you listen to the discussion of Eurofascism, and in particular, the role that the economic downturn, there's a euphemism, the economic downturn. That's like talking about death as a physiological downturn. And the economic catastrophe that has inevitably followed the globalization, the deregulation of Wall Street, and in particular, just the deregulation of the undoing of the regulation that was put in by Franklin D. Roosevelt to prevent another Great Depression. And surprise, surprise, here we go again. And bear in mind the brutal historical lesson of the Great Depression, in which the social dislocation produced by economic suffering drove people into the arms of the men on the white horse who promised a complicated solution, an easy solution to complicated problems. Also, remember Emery's eighth principle, those seeking easy answers get final solutions. We're going to plunge right in with an article from the British Daily Telegraph from April 3rd of 2010. Again, this is by Matthew Day. Rise of Hungary's far-right Jobbik Party stirs disturbing echoes of the 1940s. And we're going to resume basically where we left off with a slight overlap. Now, they're talking about the Jobbik Party and the fact that the economic collapse has basically produced tremendous social dislocation and resulting a disillusionment with the political establishment, and that the Jobbik Party, basically the heirs to the Arrow Cross fascists of World War II, are promising, yes, we will curb foreign interests, unquote. We are the Hungary for Hungarians, and among the groups they are scapegoating are the Roma or Gypsies, as they are disparagingly referred to throughout much of Europe. Now, once again, we're going to resume directly with the reading of this article, but Jobbik's growing support has revived disturbing memories of the bloody wartime past when Hungarian fascists grabbed power and enthusiastically shipped off Jews and Gypsies, as Roma are commonly known, to Hitler's death camps. The new party is eager to solve what it calls the Roma problem, though it emphasizes that this should be through social measures and it does not espouse violence. Some members have made comments portrayed as anti-Jewish, despite the party leadership's effort to look modern and European as well as tough. Its acceptable face is Kristina Morvai, a blonde working mother of three and former lawyer who was last year elected as a member of the European Parliament. She has complained bitterly that the rest of Europe sees her as a Nazi. That is in part because of the Hungarian Guard, who are allies of the party and also Jobbik's red and white striped banner. This bears an unnerving similarity to the emblem of the pro-Nazi Arrow Cross Party, which seized power for a few brutal months in 1944. By the way, the Arrow Cross was actually officially in power for a relatively short period of time, but Hungary was an ally of the Axis and participated in the invasion of the former Soviet Union. However, when they began to waver and when the advancing Red Army's power began to convince the Hungarians to become front runners, that's basically what they were. When Hitler was winning, they allied with Hitler, and when it was obvious that the Red Army was going to drive Hitler from Eastern Europe, they decided that perhaps discretion was the better part of valor under the circumstances and were moving in the direction of allying themselves with the Allies late in the war. So the Nazis basically formally installed the Arrow Cross Party. Continuing with the article, for those old enough to remember the suffering of the war, the rise of Jobbik feels like a frightening case of deja vu. Though I was only 6 years old in 1944 when the Arrow Cross came to power, I remember the reign of terror that followed, said Maria Jahus, a Budapest pensioner. I remember when they took away the Jews, including our village doctor, and the young men they hanged at the side of the road with placards round their necks saying, "This is the fate of deserters," unquote. The Hungarian Guard and Jobbik, the uniforms, the language, and rhetoric all remind me of the Arrow Cross and that era, unquote. Accusations of racism or anti-Semitism are dismissed by Jobbik's leaders, who argue that radical policies are needed to lift Hungary's 500,000 Roma out of poverty. Mr. Vona, a surprisingly bland and modest-looking leader for such an extreme party, was a founding member of Jobbik in 2003. His youth appeals to Hungarian voters who are sick of the old political class. His quietly spoken personality seems to reassure voters, although in July of last year he was arrested at a demonstration in central Budapest. By the way, I may be mispronouncing many of the names in this. Please bear with me, but I'm doing the best I can. By the way, one of the things that we're going to be talking about as we get into this side is the fact that the old guard and their perpetuation around the world is one of the reasons why the new generation, this new wave, so to speak, of fascism, Euro-fascism, and in other countries, other types of fascism, including in the Islamic world, Islamic fascism behind the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic fascist organization allied with the Axis in World War II, and like so many fascist organizations, it jumped to sponsorship in the post-war period on the part of Western intelligence services, the CIA in particular, who saw in its fascist and anti-communist dogma a valuable ally in the Cold War. One of the things to note is that the SS gained control of the various, full control, administrative control, of the various Eastern European fascist organizations, such as the Romanian Iron Guard and the Hungarian Arrow Cross. And when those organizations' residua, many of them anyway, jumped to the United States, to Western intelligence, and to the Republican Party, where they evolved into a major element of the Republican Party, those elements and the SS jumped with them. A key Arrow Cross veteran is a guy named Laszlo Pastor, who became the primary functionary of this Nazi and fascist element in the Republican Party, an element that dominates the Republican ethnic outreach organizations. And we're going to talk later in the broadcast about the OUNB, a Ukrainian fascist organization that really is a remarkable example of how this dynamic operates. Reprising an article that we touched on briefly at the end of For the Record 707. This, again, an indication of how the post-war perpetuation of fascist elements within the corridors of power for the purposes of prosecuting some of those eventually who were the targets of their scapegoating, but prosecuting the Cold War. The following article is really quite remarkable, very important, and of course has been almost completely overlooked. This is an article from the estimable German publication Spiegel, and from Spiegel Online of March 11th of 2010, we find the Eichmann Files, classified documents could be released after 50 years. It's by Leon Disha Becker, and this is, should be said, 50 more years, because the files have been kept classified. Now, Eichmann, who was the formal administrator of the liquidation of European Jewry, he was executed in 1961, or perhaps he was tried in 61 and executed in 62. I think his execution followed shortly upon his conviction, but we're now almost 50 years after his death, okay? And this was somebody who was operating in World War II. Why is the German government and the German intelligence service, the BND, the successor to the Reinhard-Gehlen spy outfit, why do you suppose they are keeping the Eichmann files secret at this point? The official version, by the way, is that the file contains information provided by a collaborating intelligence service, and the hint here is that it was the Israeli Mossad. As critics have pointed out, if they wanted to sanitize the information in order to keep that clandestine, all they had to do was black out the name of the intelligence service. There was no need to keep the files on someone who's been dead for almost half a century secret for another half a century. Actually, there is. This, again, from the Spiegel article of March 11th, 2010, the Eichmann Files, classified documents could be released after 50 years. It reads in part, 50 years after Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann's arrest by the Israeli Mossad in Argentina, basic details about his 15 years as a fugitive remain a government secret. The files kept by Germany's Foreign Intelligence Service, the BND, remain classified today, allegedly for reasons of national security. A German journalist is now suing at a federal court for the release of the files. 50 years have passed since Adolf Eichmann's arrest, but the German Foreign Intelligence Agency, the BND, is still hoping to prevent the release of files detailing his post-war movements. A federal administrative court in Leipzig is currently examining 4,500 pages of secret documents on Eichmann, a leading architect of Hitler's plans to murder Europe's Jews. The court is soon expected to rule whether the BND's justifications for concealing the files are still applicable and in line with the country's freedom of information laws. Skipping down, Uki Goni, a prominent Argentine journalist and expert on the post-war Nazi fugitives, has taken a special interest in the BND files and thinks that references to a foreign intelligence service are a smokescreen. Quote, "They could easily redact the name of the intelligence service and the name of the informants," he told Spiegel Online. "The files would not be embarrassing to any other secret service but to Germany itself," unquote. Goni believes the files would reveal hitherto unknown levels of collusion between the German government and Nazis who fled overseas to escape prosecution. In his book, The Real Odessa, which describes how the Perón regime systematically aided Nazi war criminals, Goni documents how Nazi war criminals lived free and easy in Buenos Aires. German Foreign Service members and Nazis visited the same establishments and drank in the same beer hall. The Nazis didn't hide their allegiances either. Quoting from Goni, "The Nazis would come in, click their heels, and throw up their traditional salute," Goni told Spiegel Online. Eichmann didn't feel the need to keep a low profile in that community. The German embassy in Buenos Aires gave his wife and children passports in their own name, just as they had given infamous Nazi doctor Josef Mengele a passport. Attorney Rainer Gulen thinks that the most explosive information enclosed in the files pertains to Eichmann's flight from Germany. Quote, "He was very chatty in Jerusalem. He knew he was going to die anyway," Gulen said. According to Gulen, Eichmann explained in great detail who helped him flee Germany and then Europe, information the Israelis were very interested in. "There is good reason to believe that he received help from German, Italian, and Vatican officials," he said. Well, there's so many things I've spoken about there. Argentina, what more is there to be said? There's a reference to the Juan Perón regime. In the book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, on page 205, by the way, that consummately important book, the reading of which I think is really essential to an understanding of these broadcasts, it's available for download for free on the website. And on page 205, you'll not only read that Martin Bormann had been banking under his own name since 1941, he held a joint bank account with Juan Perón, and also on August, I think it was 4th, 8th, 3 days in August of 1967, he wrote checks on demand accounts in three leading New York banks, all of which cleared through Deutsche Bank in Buenos Aires. Again, I think that what is really of note here is not the collaborating Foreign Intelligence Service, but the fact that at an institutional level, the denazification of Germany is simply a myth. The political leadership of Germany in the immediate post-war, but for decades in the post-war period, was administered by people who were Third Reich collaborators and specifically tabbed by the Third Reich to perpetuate it in Germany at an underground level. Really not an underground level, but at a sanitized overground level. As far as Eichmann, in For the Record 558, the Eichmann file, we noted that he had been detained for a time by U.S. intelligence and then, quote, escaped, unquote. And in the 1950s, Eichmann himself became a CIA contract agent, helping to train the Egyptian intelligence service and the Egyptian general staff. By the way, he was not a full-time employee of the Central Intelligence Agency. He was simply hired by the Skorzeny/Heinrich Mueller contingent in order to go to Egypt and train the Egyptians in a fashion desired by the underground Reich and in a sufficiently anti-communist fashion to please Alan Dulles' CIA. Again, that discussed at great length and for the record 558, the Eichmann file. And it should also be noted that for a time, Adolf Eichmann's immediate superior, the man to whom he reported for a period of time in the SS, was none other than Otto von Bolschwing, who also was brought to the United States, and he went to work for the CIA, and he was no bloody contract agent. He was a full-time employee, and it was one of his proteges, Helena von Damm, who basically staffed. She selected the lists from which Ronald Reagan made all of his appointments. And when he was governor of California, she then jumped to the White House and she selected the lists of all of the personnel from which Ronald Reagan made his cabinet appointments when he was president of the United States. This, the inevitable outcome, a lot of these crumbs were the outcome of the Crusade for Freedom. That was an illegal domestic intelligence operation in which many of these Nazis and fascists were brought over to the United States, not just to work for the intelligence services, but to become leaders in our Eastern European ethnic communities and ultimately to become a key element of the Republican Party. That program was the brainchild of Alan Dulles, the director of the CIA, and along with his brother John Foster, key partner in the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm. The person who oversaw it was Dulles' protege, a young California congressman named Richard Nixon. The chief spokesperson for that program was a young B-grade Hollywood movie actor named Ronald Reagan. The person who oversaw that program for the State Department machinations to bring these SOBs in was William Casey, director of the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980 and then appointed by Ronald Reagan to become head of the CIA. By the way, Casey, whose personal pilot was Heinrich Rupp, a Luftwaffe pilot who'd piloted ME-262s in the war, Casey had been Richard Nixon's head of the SEC, which is interesting in light of the Borman Capital Network and its machinations. And last but certainly not least, the Republican Nazi element of the Republican Party became permanent. It had previously been coalesced in presidential election years only, but it became a permanent fixture in the Republican Party when the chairman of the Republican National Committee was George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st president of the United States and the man for whom CIA headquarters is named. Okay. By the way, there's a new book out called Family of Secrets by Russ Baker, which talks about the very firm indications that George Herbert Walker Bush had been CIA for a long time. Officially, he only worked for the CIA for 1 year. Well, if that's the case, how come CIA headquarters is named for him? As we talk about Eurofascism, it's important to keep these kinds of networks in mind. I've noted that one of the reasons why it has been relatively easy for the new generation of European youth to fall in line with the diktats of the old guard, die alte Kameraden, is the fact that the prosecution of the Cold War was for the prosecution of the Cold War, it was deemed essential to put the old guard back into power. Now, one of the first articles that we covered in Side 1 was the fact that a German court ruling has made it possible for the NPD, the top German neo-Nazi party, to distribute CDs outside of schools to German school children. This should not come as a surprise to us past a point, because indeed NPD sympathizers slash collaborators are in power today in the German government. And we're going to check out this particular article. This is from the very important GermanForeignPolicy.com newsletter. By the way, that feeds in on the front page of SpitfireList.com, along with Lucy Commissar's brilliant work, and also the very important global Muslim Brotherhood Global Report, or the Global Muslim Brotherhood Report, Global MB Report, reporting on the machinations of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamic fascist organization, an Axis collaborator that is the parent organizations of, among other institutions, Al-Qaeda and Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. The following from GermanForeignPolicy.com is from January 19th of 2010. It's called Fraternity Brothers, Questionable Polish Borders. And it not only talks about links between key German cabinet officials, including the German Minister of Transportation, and German fraternities, unquote, that are not only the hail back to the Axis period, but also have links to the NPD. These are the Burschenschaften that we talked about in For the Record 677. But it also talks about the fact that once again, the borders between Germany and Poland are becoming an issue of contention. And indeed, German-speaking minorities in Poland are once again the focal point of agitation on the part of the German government and some of its ministers, such as we're going to be seeing here. I would note that as I'm speaking on April 11th of 2010, the president of Poland and much of the Polish political and military leadership was deep-sixed in a plane crash, which may or may not have been an accident. I think both are possible. It was an old plane, apparently was engaging in some relatively risky behavior, had been warned off, apparently, by the air traffic controllers in Smolensk, near where it crashed. But at the same time, one does have to wonder. Whenever you see important political or economic figures dying in a plane crash, a car crash, what have you, always pay attention. It may just be happenstance. There are those sorts of things that occur, but it may be much more than that as well. For example, the head of the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, one of the most powerful and wealthy of the sovereign wealth funds, he died in a hang glider accident or in a glider accident a short time ago. A lot of intrigue he was around the United Arab Emirates, so pay attention to these kinds of events. And again, excerpting from Fraternity Brothers, Questionable Polish Borders, note the following links between the German Minister of Transportation and the Deutsche Burschenschaften and the NPD, who has now been cleared to sell CDs outside of German schools. The German Minister of Transportation, Peter Ramsauer of the CSU, is a member of a student fraternity that has ties to circles of the far-right extremist National Democratic Party of Germany, or NPD. The umbrella fraternity Deutsche Burschenschaft, or DB, not only has Minister Ramsauer as a member, but also two NPD members of regional parliaments. The alleged historical merits of Nazi criminals Hess and Hitler are debated in the DB's newspaper. The fraternity, in which Ramsauer is referred to as a fraternity brother, places Poland's territorial integrity into question. In the next few weeks, Transportation Minister Ramsauer is due to reach a decision concerning Nazi victims in Poland who are demanding reparations from his ministry for damages incurred during Nazi deportation carried out with the Deutsche Reichsbahn, or German State Railroad, in World War II. Cabinet Minister Ramsauer is not alone. Hans-Peter Uhl is also a member of a fraternity with NPD ties. Uhl, UHL, is the spokesperson for domestic affairs of the conservative CDU-CSU parliamentary caucus in the German parliament, or Bundestag. Legislation concerning the surveillance of the country's right-wing extremists is among Uhl's functions. Within the spectrum of the German cabinet, Ramsauer advocates far-right-wing political standpoints. His political mentor is Otto Wieschau, who until recently was a member of the presidium of the Deutsche Bahn AG, DBAG, the German railroad, in charge of political relations, unquote. As supervising minister in charge of the DBAG, Ramsauer is continuing Wieschau's work, skipping down. For decades, Transportation Minister Ramsauer has been a member of the Franco-Bavaria Munich fraternity, one of the approximately 120 fraternities in Germany and Austria unified under the Deutsche Burschenschaft, DB, or German Fraternity umbrella organization. The DB is ethnically oriented. According to its constitutional principles, it is committed to, quote, the free development of German ethnic identity and close fellowship with all sectors of the German people, unquote. Regardless of national borders, again, unquote. In the DB manual, one reads that, by Germany, we mean the realm in Central Europe inhabited by Germans, including the regions from which Germans were illegally expelled. They maintain that, quote, an orientation of the fatherland concept of the state is only of relative significance because of the brevity and impermanence of states. In the manual, unquote, the consequences explained with an explanation of international law regarding the November 14, 1990 Polish-German border agreement. According to this argumentation, again subscribed to, obviously, by the German Minister of Transportation, according to this argumentation, Poland merely has a right to tolerated use, unquote, of its western territories, the Oder-Neisse region, again quoting, which possibly represents a sort of territorial sovereignty, unquote, while simultaneously the territorial sovereignty over the eastern region continues to remain in Germany's hands. Unquote. By the way, the official rationalization for Germany's invasion of Poland in World War II was the alleged abuse of the German-speaking minority in Poland by the Polish government, the so-called Volksdeutsche. And they were, many of them anyway, forcibly expelled by Poland at the end of World War II. In the GermanForeignPolicy.com newsletter, there is a recent article about the Vertriebene groups and the Ministry of Expelle, who were the Vertriebene groups under the stewardship of the SS and maintain very strong connections to the German government and are championing the Expelle and the German-speaking minorities in other countries. By the way, note that one of the German members of this, of the Burschenschaften, was in charge of overseeing far-right groups, seeing to it that far-right groups in Germany are controlled. Perhaps that explains why the NPD is going to be able to sell CDs outside of German schools. Note the following, again, from GermanForeignPolicy.com. Several German federal states and municipalities are using a new EU legal instrument to promote a fusion with German-speaking regions of neighboring Western nations. This is just like the appropriation by the Third Reich of the Rhineland, the Sudetenland, and the championing of the Sudeten Germans, the Volksdeutsche, and others in order to justify territorial expansion. In this case, they're simply networking with these German-speaking minorities in neighboring regions. This, again, from the GermanForeignPolicy.com newsletter. It's from Borderland Networks, March 19th of 2010. Again, talking about German-speaking minorities are now networking with cities in Germany under the auspices of the EU. Other articles, some of which we covered at the end of For the Record at 707, the Nazi and SS collaborator Stefan Bandera has been named a hero of the Ukraine by outgoing Mr. Yushchenko, and whose wife, Ekaterina Yushchenko, the former Ekaterina Chubachenko, was the head of the OUNB, the Ukrainian fascist organization, whose operations stretched through the decades and embraced things from running from the Holocaust to the assassination of President Kennedy. Austria's largest daily endorses Nazi revisionist candidate. From an AP story. Once again, revisionism in Austria is on the march. The new head of MI6, British Foreign Intelligence, his half-brother, is a researcher for Holocaust denier David Irving, who recently completed a prison sentence in Austria for denying the Holocaust. All of which is to say that when you don't clean house, you wind up with some real serious dirt. And some have observed, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. This, however, concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 709, Update on Eurofascism. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.